10. They didn't have to backtrack far to find a part of the river that was narrow and boulder-strewn enough to work their way across. They spent the remaining time until nightfall eating wolf jerky, making sure anything they had that was reflective was covered, killing the occasional river wolf, and napping in the shade of the canyon walls. When it was dark enough to launch their assault, they crossed the river. As they leapt from rock to rock, Philip and Tyler found themselves on a boulder, surrounded by rapids, with Jimmy and Gary already across. It was the first chance they had to talk even semi-privately since the quest began, and they dawdled there, pretending to take a breather to capitalize on the opportunity. Philip said,
"The boulders are just close enough together to make crossing the river possible, but dangerous. There coincidentally happens to be a side route to the castle that's just well hidden enough to be obvious. Doesn't this seem a little too easy?"
"Yeah," Tyler said. "I've been thinking about that. Two things. One, Todd is a game designer. Now, I know you mainly play stuff like Gorf and Choplifter, but games get a lot more sophisticated later on. It's not unheard of for there to be more than one way to complete a mission. Could be that he deliberately made it so we could fight our way through the front door, or sneak around back."
Philip said,
"Yeah, that would explain it."
Tyler said,
"Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that Todd went to a lot of trouble to make this quest. He wants to get maximum entertainment out of it. That means he wants us to survive, well, at least some of us, to the end. Also, he probably gave us the choice because he wants us to argue. He wants us at each other's throats."
Philip laughed.
"I wondered why you were being so nice to Jimmy."
"Yeah," Tyler said. "Until we get out of this, or he gets killed, I'm going out of my way to be civil. But make no mistake, I can't stand the sight of him. I certainly don't trust him. You?"
"You know I've disliked the bastard longer than anyone. But in a weird way, I do trust him. I trust him to do what he thinks is best for him. Right now, he stands a better chance of surviving if we all stay alive to help him. So, yeah, I trust him to help the group, for now. If at the end of this he's given a chance to sell us all out to save his own neck, I trust him to do that, too."
Philip and Tyler finally joined Jimmy and Gary on the far side of the river, and they were on their way. As predicted, there was a stratum of rock that extended from the one above it, just far enough to make a path that was wide and flat enough to walk on, yet narrow and uneven enough to cause constant fear of falling into the river. As they progressed, the canyon got deeper and the river farther below them. By the time they reached the sweeping blind corner that marked the beginning of the natural bowl that protected Castle Cragganmore, the narrow path was easily 50 feet above the river's surface, and the steep rocky slope below left no doubt in the wizards' minds that if they did fall, they'd be far too injured to swim properly by the time they made it to the water. The rapids did not look swimmable anyway, so it didn't matter. Falling from the path meant death. Whether you died from the fall or from drowning was an unimportant detail. Luckily, the soldiers all held torches, and they all had been lit at dusk. From a distance, the small army guarding the castle resembled the candles on an octogenarian's birthday cake. Clearly, they would not be able to see the wizards, as their night vision would be ruined by the torches. Nor would they even be looking for invaders halfway up the cliff wall. Even if they did, they would not fear four men foolish enough to get themselves into such a predicament in the first place.
"I gotta hand it to Gary,"
Philip thought.
"This plan is so idiotic, it kinda goes all the way around the horn to being smart."
Slowly, they inched their way along the canyon wall. The path was still the same width, but the increased height and the darkness made it more precarious. The knowledge that falling would lead to death, either by being dashed on the rocks, drowning, or most likely being dashed on the rocks and drowning, did not make the path feel wider. After what seemed like an eternity, they were behind the castle. The physical structure of the castle was noticeable for its invisibility. The dull black stone swallowed the moonlight and starlight, reflecting almost nothing back. The light shed by the soldiers' torches was visible around and through the innumerable arches, buttresses, and complications of the castle's lower structure. Higher up, light poured out from the castle's stained glass windows. Philip had never seen glass that better deserved to be referred to as stained. The color palette ranged from dark red to light brown, with the occasional spot of sickly yellow as an accent. When the wizards reached the very back of the castle, the cliff face roughened, creating a rock formation down to the riverbank that fell somewhere between being stairs and a ladder. The river itself was strewn with boulders, spaced just far enough apart that it looked as if a person could just about kill themselves trying to jump across. Gary said, "Wow! What luck!" Jimmy looked back at Philip and Tyler and gave a brief smile, a smile that said,
"I know it isn't luck, and I know you both know it too."
They carefully picked their way down the cliff. The river was a raging torrent of white water and deafening noise. Crossing the maelstrom was made all the more nerve-wracking by the fact that every single boulder they touched on their way was slick with moisture and wobbled sickeningly, as if it could let go of the riverbed and be swept away at any moment. Once they were on solid ground again, the men lay there, trying to catch their breaths and slow their heart rates. They were badly winded and soaked to the bone, both from the spray of the river and their own sweat. When they were ready, the wizards set about finding a way into the castle. The only visible windows were the large stained glass monstrosities toward the top of the castle, but they found the castle's exterior surprisingly easy to scale. They climbed the smallest buttresses with little difficulty, and they were able to scale the larger buttress with ease. The final buttress was a piece of cake. And then it was a short trip over the back of a gargoyle, and they were standing on a ledge outside a stained glass window. They had discussed the possibility of having to break the window to enter, but they found that toward the bottom of the window there was a hinged panel that allowed them to crawl into the castle. Once inside, they found themselves on a ledge approximately 10 feet above an onyx-floored terrace that overlooked the interior of the castle. They dropped to the floor as quietly as they could. From where they crouched, they could see the floor in front of them, a curved railing and a wall in the distance. From the way the railing sloped downward and the floor stopped, they could tell there were staircases leading downward to the right and the left. Gary said,
"I'll go take a look around."
He started to rise, but Philip stopped him, grabbing his arm.
"Remember," Philip said, "you don't have to whisper silently while you're sneaking."
Gary said,
"I know that. Jeez."
He turned his back to the others, bit his lip, and skulked to the railing. He cautiously peeked through the balusters. He rose a bit to look over the top of the rail. He extended his head well out over the handrail and craned his neck one way, then the other. He stood up straight, turned to face the others, and shrugged. After a moment's thought, he held up one finger as a suggestion that they wait. Then he snuck to the staircase. He looked around, clearly saw nobody, and crept down the stairs. Philip followed, just far enough to watch Gary make his way down the stairs. Tyler and Jimmy both went to the handrail, and like Gary before them, they saw nobody. The hall was large, ornate, and empty. The room was a large circle. The wall opposite them was taken up mostly by the immense arched doorway that was being guarded on the other side by the torch-bearing soldiers. Luckily, the door was closed. The wizard saw no reason to change that. The floor was mostly onyx, with soapstone and black granite. The lack of clear color contrast made it difficult to tell, but the floor was inlaid with the same pattern as the 6 stained glass windows that circled the upper half of the chamber, except where the door was in the way. Big, decorative torches blazed away on every wall. There was no furniture. The inlaid pattern on the floor was marred only by 2 slightly raised platforms, sat a bit over halfway between the front and back walls. They were equidistant from each other and the sides of the circular room, like the eyes on a smiley face. On each platform, there was a large lever. Gary reached the bottom of the stairs. He held onto the banister with both hands and looked in every conceivable direction. He looked again. Looked up to Philip at the top of the stairs and to Tyler and Jimmy peering over the railing and raised his eyebrows as if to say, "What the heck?" Gary tiptoed around the end of the banister, into the area immediately in front of the terrace. He took three steps, then glanced into the area beneath the terrace, jumped straight up in the air, and said, "Ah!" Philip, Tyler, and Jimmy all yelped, cringed, and withdrew several feet into the shadows. Gary leapt back and grasped the banister with both hands as if he were playing tag and the railing was base. For a moment, they all silently exchanged panicked eye contact, but nothing happened. Finally, Gary ventured to retrace his steps, more slowly this time, and to peek back into the area beneath the terrace. Gary leaned to the side and peered with one eye into the place where he'd seen whatever had startled him. The others remained silent, ready to defend themselves if possible, or, more likely, flee. Gary peered into the area they could not see. The others held their breath. Gary continued to look at whatever it was. Then he waved. Tyler and Jimmy glanced at each other quizzically. Gary gritted his teeth, stood up, and in a loud voice said, "It's a mirror! Come on down, guys!" Philip, Tyler, and Jimmy walked down the stairs. They still made an effort to be quiet, but if Gary's yelp hadn't drawn any attention, nothing they did would. When they reached the bottom of the stairs, they could see that immediately beneath, in the terrace they'd been standing on, the wall was decorated with a spiral design about 20 feet in diameter. It was made of individual slabs of polished stone and looked like a camera's aperture. On either side of the aperture were large decorative mirrors. They were clearly the only people in the chamber, and looking around, it was clear that the only ways in or out were either the massive doors at the front of the room, the stone aperture at the back, or the stained glass windows that ring the upper portion of the wall. Jimmy said, "It's a bit, I don't know, spare, isn't it?" Philip said,
"Well, I'm afraid not everyone has the good taste to coat every available surface in their castle with 14-karat gold, like you did."
"That's not fair," Jimmy said. "It wasn't every surface. I didn't have the marble floors covered with gold foil. One must show some restraint. Besides, I noticed none of you were offended enough by it to tear the castle down once I was gone."
Philip said,
"After all the work the citizens put into building the place, they'd have killed us if we tried to tear it down. We'd already been chased by one murderous mob that week and didn't want to do it again."
Jimmy chose to let the subject drop, as he was the one who had set the first mob on them. He saw no way to win this argument. Tyler was standing on one of the raised platforms. He took the lever in both hands and tried to pull it, but couldn't make it budge.
"Hey, Gary," he said, "there are two levers. Let's try pulling both of them at the same time."
Gary mounted the other platform and grasped the lever. Tyler said,
"On three."
Gary nodded. At the same instant, Tyler said,
"One."
And Gary said,
"Three."
They both stopped. Tyler repeated,
"I said, on three."
Gary said,
"Sorry, I thought we'd count down."
"Well, what sense does that make?"
Tyler asked.
"If we go on three, then start with three, we pull the levers right away, then just count down to zero afterward. We might as well just say now and pull the levers."
Jimmy said,
"Why don't you do that?"
Tyler and Gary both looked at Jimmy, making it clear that his input was not required. Jimmy muttered an apology and looked to Philip, who shook his head ruefully. Gary said,
"Whatever, let's just do this."
Tyler counted to three, then they both pulled, and with the sound of an enormously heavy lid sliding off the world's largest toilet tank, the aperture in the wall spiraled open like the iris of an immense eye. Torches set into the walls beyond lit a stairway down into inky blackness. Philip and Jimmy approached the opening. The air that rose to meet them smelled like centuries of decay. As Philip and Jimmy started to cross the threshold into the passage below, Tyler and Gary let go of their levers so they could follow. As soon as they were no longer holding the levers in place, the levers whipped back to their original positions, like the throwing arms of synchronized catapults. The stone aperture slammed shut and would have taken Philip's leg if Jimmy hadn't yanked him out of harm's way. Tyler said,
"Huh. Sorry about that, Philip. I guess Gary and I'll wait here."
"I guess," Gary agreed.
Tyler grasped the handle again and said,
"Okay. On three."
Gary glared at him. Tyler counted to three. The levers were pulled, and the aperture spun open again. Philip and Jimmy approached the opening, keeping an eye on Tyler and Gary as they did. Once they were safely beyond the opening, Philip asked,
"Will it be a problem for you two to hold the door open? I don't know how we'd get a signal to you that we're ready to come out, and we might be coming back out in a hurry."
Tyler said,
"Shouldn't be a problem. What do you think, Gary?"
Gary said,
"Sure, as long as you don't take too long."
Philip and Jimmy walked down the stairs. The torches, set at regular intervals along both sides of the staircase, seemed to stretch into infinity. Thick cobwebs clung to the walls. A layer of dust you could draw in coated the steps. The torches cast large shadows that leapt and danced menacingly as the flames flickered. Philip said,
"Gotta hand it to Todd. He did a good job of making this place seem ancient. I wonder how much time he spent just getting the cobwebs right."
Jimmy said, "Probably very little. If I had to guess, I'd say that he designed the castle, picked the location and period of history he wanted to put it in, then built this passage a few hundred years earlier. Why artificially age the place when it's just as easy to let it age on its own?"
Philip was amazed.
"All these years of time travel experience, and that still simply didn't occur to me."
Jimmy chuckled.
"Yeah, you and I, we did the same thing. We learned how to time travel and teleport. We found a new time and place to call home. Then we called that good and pretty much stayed there. We made a nest for ourselves. Of course, you did a better job. I made a real hash of it."
"That's what you call it?"
Philip asked.
"You lied, manipulated, accidentally killed an entire town, and tried to kill all the rest of us. And you say you made a hash of it?"
"Yes," Jimmy said, "I do. Because if I dwell on what I did for too long, I spiral into a depression that takes days to drag myself out of. Anyway, back to my original point, we use time travel as a simple means of transportation, but it can be much more. It can be a powerful tool if you think about it."
Philip looked sideways at Jimmy.
"And you've thought about it?"
"While I was in exile, I spent 30 years traveling by foot and bicycle from Argentina to the Pacific Northwest. I had plenty of time to think."
Philip said,
"Hey, wait a minute. Considering what you did, I think 30 years of exile is pretty damned lenient. In fact..."
"Hey, no argument. I did not mean to suggest that I've been treated badly. Really, Phil, at the time I resisted... But in retrospect, I'm nothing but grateful that you didn't just kill me and be done with it. I certainly gave you enough reason. I was just describing the situation, not blaming anyone but myself for it."
Philip said,
"Okay, then."
But it didn't sound like it was okay.
"You've never said that before."
Jimmy said,
"We don't exactly talk much, which, again, I don't blame you for. Like I said, I killed a town." If the current manifestation of my punishment is that I'm a pariah, I'm still getting off pretty easy.
The two men walked in silence for several seconds before Jimmy decided to risk saying what was on his mind.
By the way, he said, I think I know that you and Tyler were talking about me back when we first crossed the river.
You think so? Philip asked.
Yes. It was the first chance you'd had to have a private conversation since the quest started, and I'm pretty sure you were discussing whether or not you could trust me.
Philip nodded.
What do you think?
Jimmy smiled.
There are a few answers to that question. I know that you can trust me, and I don't think you will. I think you were perfectly right to want to discuss it. I think that if I were in your place, I'd have a great deal of difficulty ever trusting me again. I think that if you did trust me, that I'd be extremely reticent to ever betray that trust, unless I had a very good reason. Which sounds bad, but if you think about it, that's the most you can really ever trust anyone. Lastly, I think that if I were you, I'd trust me to do what's best for me. And to that end, let me assure you, it's best for me to keep the three of you alive and happy. I have a much better chance of survival if I have you here to help me. Besides, when we return to Lead Church and have to explain that Jeff is not coming back with us, I fully expect everyone to suspect that I had something to do with it, no matter what you three say. Imagine if I came back without any of you.
Jimmy's analysis of the situation exactly matched Philip's. Philip didn't know how he felt about that. He didn't have long to dwell on it, because in the distance, they could see the end of what had looked like an endless line of torches and the entrance to some sort of very well-lit chamber. It was hard to know how far underground they were. The staircase had been several hundred yards long, at least. They reached the landing, and the passage widened into a large chamber that appeared to be shaped roughly like a cube. It was full of unusual items. They decided to investigate. Set along the sides of the chamber, there were six large stone bowls, three bowls to each side. Each bowl contained a roaring fire. Beside each bowl, there was a large glass lens set in a bronze fitting, focusing the light from the fire in a specific direction. In the center of the room, on a stone pedestal, there was a statue of a muscular warrior god. The statue had six overdeveloped arms, each wielding a dagger. The daggers had dull metal handles, but the blades were polished to a mirror finish. Also, the arms looked to be jointed at the shoulder so that they could swing through a specific range of motion. On the far wall of the chamber, there was an ornately carved stone door, covered with cryptic symbols that neither Philip nor Jimmy recognized. Several feet in front of the door, on either side, there were three large stone cylinders set into the floor, six in total. The cylinders were also covered with cryptic markings. In front of each set of cylinders, there was a handrail and a small mirror on a pole. Philip said,
I think it may be some kind of puzzle.
Philip and Jimmy solved the puzzle, but only after quite a bit of trial and error and no small amount of frustration. When stone doors slowly opened, the two men were so relieved they nearly hugged. Their exuberance was muted by the fact that they could hear distant voices coming from the dim passage beyond the door. They crept in as quietly as they could. The passage led to a treasure chamber. Heaped all around the walls were piles and piles of precious objects that had clearly been obtained and hoarded at great effort. There were sculptures of chariots, horses, mighty warriors, and beautiful women, ranging in size from about 4 inches to full size. There were artworks depicting horses, chariots, mighty warriors, and beautiful women hanging on the walls and resting on the floors, leaning against the piles of other glittering loot. There were ostentatious cloaks and boots hewn from fine fabric and supple leather. Many of them bore pictograms of horses, chariots, mighty warriors, and beautiful women. They littered the floor, far too many for any one man to need. There were also crowns of various size and design, all distinct while remaining essentially the same. Despite the opulence, there were only two real pieces of furniture, a large, comfortable-looking throne, and a stone stand for displaying the most precious possession of all, or at least the most entertaining to look at. Philip thought,
"It's like a bachelor's apartment, dipped in gold."
A gangly king sat at the throne, dressed in an oversized crown and ermine robes colored green and gold, similar to the robes Jimmy wore back when he called himself Merlin. The king was cackling with delight. His crown slid around on his too narrow head as he rocked with laughter. As the king squirmed with delight, Philip briefly caught a glimpse of his face and immediately recognized it as an unflattering caricature of Jimmy. The object of the king's laughter was instantly clear. On the table opposite the throne rested a beautiful golden birdcage. Inside the cage, a canary that appeared to be made from hammered bronze and clockwork parts was waving its wings and swooning as if it might soon fall unconscious. In front of the table, a short, fat man in a sky-blue court jester costume was leaning on the birdcage with his sweat-stained armpit looming menacingly directly over the poor creature's head. As the clockwork canary choked and the king laughed, the jester stood straight, spun in place, and took a bow. Despite the too prominent nose, the eyes being too close together, and the teeth being too far apart, the jester was clearly meant to be Philip.
"More!"
the king cried, pounding on the arms of his throne.
"More!"
The jester bowed and said,
"As you demand, your stuposity."
The king clapped his hands with delight as the jester turned and regarded the canary, who could only be Oban, the canary the miners had lost. Oban had just stopped coughing and was catching its breath. The jester leaned forward, putting his face right up to the bars of the cage. Oban eyed him wearily. The jester opened his mouth and belched extravagantly right into Oban's face. The metal bird hacked and wheezed, much to the king's delight.
"Oh,"
Philip moaned.
"It's just so lowbrow."
Through gritted teeth, Jimmy whispered,
"We've gotta save the bird before that fool farts."
Philip's hand went to his sword. He said,
"You take the jester. I'll handle the king."
Jimmy said,
"Done."
The two men rushed from the shadows, swords drawn, screaming bloody murder. Jimmy closed the gap between himself and the jester almost instantly. The jester didn't even have time to raise his hands before Jimmy brought the pommel of his sword down on the jester's skull, instantly knocking him unconscious. Jimmy turned triumphantly to show Philip his handiwork, but was struck speechless by what he saw. The king had managed to rise from his throne and offer some resistance. Not enough, clearly, as the king's left hand and half of his forearm were lying on the stone floor, and Philip's sword was buried deep in the king's ribcage, having gotten there by chopping through the royal trapezius and clavicle. Philip jerked at his sword, but it did not budge. The king slumped down into his throne and leaned backward as far as he could, with Philip's sword protruding from his back. Philip raised a foot, braced it on the king's torso, and pulled his sword free. He turned around to face Jimmy, grinning from ear to ear. He saw the jester, lying unconscious but alive on the ground, and the look on Jimmy's face, and said,
"Oh, sorry. Look, it wasn't really you."
Jimmy said, "Yeah, I get it."
He lifted the birdcage and said, "Come on, Oban, let's take you home." Oban fluttered happily, emitting a slight clanking noise. As they left the treasure chamber, Philip said,
"He wasn't real."
"Yeah, whatever. I know."
"Would it help if I said I was sorry?"
Jimmy said,
"Maybe. if I thought you meant it.